This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
In November, Hurricane Nicole swept away foundations along the Florida coast. The nightly news flashed images of homes and apartment buildings fallen into the sea or tottering dangerously at the edge. This is a glimpse into the future as ice disappears from the poles. To get a global picture of the changing ice world, a network of scientists formed the International Cryosphere Initiative. Their State of the Cryosphere 2022 report finds sea ice and glaciers from the poles to the Himalayas are endangered species. We reached Julia Brigham Grett, a scientist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-author of the new report. Julie is an authority on glacial geology and their history and past climates. From Massachusetts, Julie Brigham Grett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
From research vessels to camps on the ice, you have seen what we have not. What is it like to be a human in the presence of vast ice more than a mile deep?
It's an awesome experience because of the power that you feel when the ice calves from the front in a tidewater glacier, when that ice falls off and that booming sound happens. It's just an awesome feeling of the power of that ice. And also, as a geologist, seeing the erosion and the capacity of these ice sheets to change our planet, that's an awesome feeling that I get when I'm near a glacier.
Well, just to be clear, what is the cryosphere? Is it just ice at the poles?
No, actually, the cryosphere is a term that refers to everything that's frozen in the sense of, we think of glaciers and ice sheets first, but it also includes the sea ice in the polar regions, the seasonal changes in sea ice. It also includes the permafrost, the frozen ground that's year after year stays below freezing across large swaths of the Arctic. And we also include in the cryosphere the mountain glaciers, the small ice sheets and small glaciers in like the Andes and the Himalayas and even in the Cascades of the Pacific Northwest. These are essentially water towers for the planet that feed water supplies to the people who live in those regions. So the cryosphere includes all of those things. And the other thing that we've also included in our report is the effect of ocean acidification in the polar regions, and that is the changing pH in the ocean caused by CO2 in the atmosphere.
What has that got to do with the ice, though?
Well, so as the CO2 in the atmosphere is currently increasing 10 times than anything we've seen in 50 million years, literally, we're seeing this rapid rise in CO2 caused by humans, and that CO2 gets absorbed into the surface ocean. And so it lowers the pH, and it makes it much more difficult for calcium organisms to calcify their shells. So the base of the food chain in a lot of the surface oceans of the polar regions are based on these small organisms, and many of them are having trouble making their shells and surviving, and it takes a long time for that to recover. So we include that as part of our concerns about the polar regions. You know, anybody that's opened a bottle of champagne or even a soda of some sort knows that carbon dioxide will stay more dissolved in cold water than it does in warm water. So just try opening a warm bottle of champagne sometime and you'll know what I mean. So in the polar regions, that cold water has the capacity to take up even more CO2. And so we're seeing an increase in calcium carbonate. So it doesn't really have much to do with glaciers, and it's not exactly my field of study, but it is a concern because it goes in parallel with what's happening to the glaciers and ice sheets, to the cryosphere, with our increasing fossil fuel use.
I began talking about wrecked coastlines. Do you think melting ice at both poles is already contributing to wrecked coastlines?
Absolutely. It's a crisis that's being felt in many parts of the world. I've been working with indigenous people living along the southwest coast of Alaska. Some people refer to this area as the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. It's a large, flat landscape that is sinking naturally because it's a delta, so it's receiving weight from the Yukon River, from the sediments. But also sea level is rising there, and there's tremendous coastal erosion there, because it's permafrost, frozen ground at the coast, that's also being thermally eroded. So this is, in many ways, ground zero for Alaska, oddly enough, a state that, of course, extracts a lot of fossil fuels. But sea level is rising all over. For example, forecasts are for the Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Florida coastline, there could be as many as 6 to 10 million people that need to move in the coming decades. And this is schools, factories, cities, and no one's talking about this enough. So in our own country and across the world, sea level is rising, and unfortunately, it's not reversible. You know, sea level rise is essentially forever on human timescales.
You talked about the thrill, if I could say it that way, of seeing these glaciers calve away. And I know that 10 or 15 years ago, reading reports from glaciologists, it seemed like that was the main concern of how water was going to reach the oceans. But now a recent study from Antarctica discovers a deep river running from lakes below the glaciers to the Southern Ocean. Is it possible there's a massive underground of meltwater in both Antarctica and Greenland that we don't know a lot about yet? And if so, what would that mean for sea level rise?
Well, exactly. One thing we have learned from both Greenland and parts of Antarctica are there are subglacial lakes in many places that we didn't realize. And now that we know that they're there, scientists are discovering even more of them as the geophysics improves. And we're now capable to actually see these lakes communicate to one another. So you can actually, there are scientists who can actually see the surface of the ice sheet slightly go up and down as these water bodies underneath drain from one lake to another. And the problem with that much water at the base of the glaciers, at the base of the ice sheets, is that, of course, they're not in contact with the bed, so they're not, there's a loss of friction. Just like hydroplaning with your car on a wet, rainy day, you lose contact and lose friction, and this will cause the glaciers to slide even faster. And we have to go back to when Canada and North America were covered with large ice sheets. We find evidence that this happened in these earlier glaciations as well. We can learn by looking at past ice sheets about what we might think about the behavior of the ice sheets we have left on the planet. So it is a serious concern, and we now know there's a lot more water at the bottom of these glaciers than we thought before.
Well, let's look at the new report. The State of the Cryosphere report summarizes the main threats with four different futures, depending on our emissions, of course. And the first is very low to low emissions, and it sounds like something we could have hoped for 20 years ago, but for me, that's in the rearview mirror. Not everyone agrees with that. What do you think? Should we really be counting on these low to very low emission scenarios?
Well, we have to remain hopeful to slow down the warming of the planet. And I have to say I agree with you. I think overshoot, going beyond 1.5 degrees, we're already at 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial for the planet. So dropping our emissions to keep the planet below 1.5 does seem like a long shot, a real long shot. But the truth is, the other scenarios, particularly if we go over 2 to 3 degrees, there's some really critical tipping points with the glaciers and ice sheets that could be surpassed, particularly if we go beyond 2 and to 3 degrees. And let me give you an example. I've studied across the Arctic a time period about 3 million years ago, which really isn't that long ago, but 3 million years ago when there was no Greenland ice sheet, there was no sea ice in the Arctic, and we had forested conditions all across Arctic Canada. In fact, even Hudson's Bay hadn't formed yet. And at that time, the temperature of the planet was about 3 degrees above pre-industrial, only 3 degrees. And we think that the CO2 in the atmosphere at that time was around 400 ppm. So we are already driving the planet toward an environment of what the Earth looked like 3 million years ago with no Greenland ice sheet and probably no West Antarctic ice sheet. And as far as scientists around the world, from the Mediterranean to Australia, New Zealand, and even Alaska, sea level, we think, was around 16 to 23 meters above present at that time. So we're driving the planet, even at 3 degrees, we're driving the planet toward massive sea level rise over the coming centuries. So, you know, the predictions right now are at least probably 1 meter by the time today's first graders are in their 80s. You know, so a meter of sea level rise, if you just look at a place like Florida, is pretty devastating. You know, I think overshoot is likely. We're going to have to get involved with pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and, you know, all hands on deck approach to decreasing CO2.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is expert glaciologist Professor Julie Brigham Grett from the University of Massachusetts, and we're talking about the new 2022 report on world ice. Let's talk about sea ice. In 2007, even scientists were shocked when the Arctic sea ice shrank way back. 2012 was even worse. What is the current state of Arctic sea ice?
Not a happy one, for sure. What scientists who model the Arctic sea ice are seeing, of course, a dramatic shift toward a more open, ice-free Arctic. And we've lost nearly most of the multi-year ice, the ice that's quite several meters thick that persists year after year. There's very little multi-year ice left in the Arctic. And I speak from experience in that when I was first doing fieldwork in 1980 in Arctic Alaska, I got stuck in the sea ice, even in August. But now there's largely open water across the coast of Alaska and certainly parts of Arctic Canada in places where it used to be frozen all the time. And unfortunately and symbolically, about a week ago or a while ago here at the COP in Egypt, a symbolically tipped over a large, what we call a Toblerone, is like a pillar that had Arctic sea ice written on the side of it, and they toppled it over because we have crossed a tipping point with Arctic sea ice. Even if we drop all the CO2 in the atmosphere and the methane in the atmosphere tomorrow, it's very likely we're still going to see an ice-free Arctic in the coming decades. And in literally 10 to 20, 30 years, the Arctic will be ice-free. So we've kind of missed that tipping point. We're beyond that now, and this is what we worry is we cannot miss other tipping points. So we can slow it down, and Arctic sea ice is something we can bring back if we can cool the planet and lower CO2. So in contrast to sea level, Arctic sea ice is something we could bring back eventually, in the summer sea ice I'm talking about.
Well, scientists on the show have warned an Arctic without sea ice in the summer, the so-called Blue Ocean event, would make changes all over the world. And I noticed that in your report, you even mentioned that sea ice levels can affect faraway lands like Tibet. How is that possible?
Well, an open Arctic Ocean really starts to change. It's absorbing more heat, and of course, it has downstream effects that it can affect the polar front, the way the westerlies are traveling, the waviness of the polar front, and therefore have downstream effects throughout the climate system. And I think that the adage that, you know, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic is really true, is that the Arctic system and is linked to the global atmospheric system, just like our oceans are. And so we have to expect that there will be effects in other places. I think most people are familiar with the fact that when we have an El Nino event in the South Pacific, it's a warming of the surface oceans. And even though it's so far away in the South Pacific, it has impacts all over the world, causing droughts in Africa, for example. So I think we really need to hopefully raise awareness that the Earth is a complete complex system. So what happens in one place can affect other places, downflow, down ice, and downwind.
Is there other new science that you would like to tell us about in our understanding of ice and climate change at the poles?
I think what's surprising everyone, and you've already hinted about this, is the rate at which things are happening. And I think one of the maybe more frightening revelations that's really emerging now is the amount of CO2 and methane coming from permafrost, from frozen ground as it starts to thaw across large parts of the Arctic. And here again, that flux of even more CO2 and methane into the atmosphere, it means that countries around the world have to even increase their ambition to decrease CO2 to compensate for what now looks like a natural emission due to the warming of the high latitudes. So one thing that's been happening is we're talking about the whole region of permafrost as a country in and of itself. It already has more emissions coming from permafrost than from the country of Japan, industrialized country of Japan. So the country of permafrost is really a new revelation that we're really trying to grapple with, because, again, it's going to take all. We have to cool the planet as fast as we can in order to slow down the emissions from the permafrost. I would say that would be my number one pick for large surprises.
In the English language expression, anything glacial means something moving so slow that we don't really see it. And at the 2012 AAAS conference, the presentations by glaciologists were sparsely attended. I was the only reporter in the room. Now the alarming state of the ice is reaching the front page. When you began your career, did you ever think you would see so much change in your lifetime?
Not at all. In fact, when I was in graduate school, so let's go back 40 years, I was taught that the Greenland ice sheet and Antarctica were stable, and they have been stable for 5,000 years, and that we weren't worried about that. So we were going about our research, studying the past history without so much concern about the future. And here we are so many years later, and we're in the face of really rapid change. In fact, let me mention that we're now going into Antarctic summer, okay, in the Southern Hemisphere. Over this past few months, there hasn't been much sea ice around McMurdo Station in Antarctica. That's just shocking, because 25 years ago, I was on a National Academy study about how we need to build more icebreakers to get fuel into McMurdo Station in Antarctica. Now there's no sea ice. And so that, in just 25 years, to see an area around Antarctica go from heavy, thick sea ice to not having much at all is just shocking. And I also, as I mentioned earlier, reminisce back to the times when I was working along the Arctic coast and constantly had to deal with sea ice. I could go there today and not have any problems with sea ice at all, because it's retreated so far back to the north in the summer. So this is happening fast within even my own career. So I can't be more shocked than anyone, because I've seen it myself. And if you just speak to the indigenous people living in the Arctic, they will also share their story about this change.
Well, I'm thinking about how we're going to get this word out. And last year, Argentina's parliament passed the National Law of Comprehensive Environmental Education. So the environment will be taught to students of all ages there. Can we teach kids how the cryosphere works, and should we?
Absolutely. We need to teach them about the cryosphere, about the rate at which things are happening, and also provide hope and have them see a future in their contributions to decreasing CO2, to changing the way that we develop our energy. And also to help, we're going to need psychologists, we're going to need lawyers, we're going to need all kinds of people, not just scientists, to help the particularly coastal environments adapt. We're going to need new ways to grow food. Think about, instead of a couple of days above 100 degree Fahrenheit in the central part of the United States, we're going to have 3 months of over 100 degrees. Canada might end up growing a lot more food. We have all kinds of reasons to bring everyone to the table to work on a more sustainable future, and to be optimistic that, yes, we have the tools to change, and people can be optimistic about contributing to that. So we need to keep our young people enthusiastic about their role in helping us reverse the damage that we've caused to the planet, and for them to see a future in that that's helpful and can help change the world. Because being pessimistic is just not going to be very, very hopeful. It's not being optimistic is going to be a bummer, and it just is not going to move us forward. So I believe in optimism and looking at a ways for people all to contribute to making the world a better place.
I'm not sure I agree. I don't feel optimistic myself that we can avoid a catastrophic loss of this planetary cooling system. It seems like it's on its way out. It may take hundreds of years or a couple thousand years to really go, but it's just hard for me to build optimism about that. Where I have my optimism is that humans will somehow adapt, and so will the other animals and plants, and we will find a new but different world.
That's very possible, and I certainly would not disagree, but I do think that we all have a place where we can think about a more sustainable and resilient world to the changes that we face. And with that, there has to be hope and optimism.
As we wrap this up, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Other than I think it's really important for everyone to be aware. Think about the global system, not just your own backyard, but think about what's happening to the planet as a whole and to people across the world. And I think we need to really increase our empathy for all of humanity and for all of living systems. And I really wish that global, act locally, think globally type of idea would really resonate around the world.
From the University of Massachusetts Amherst, we've been speaking with Professor Julie Brigham Grett. Julie is co-author of The State of the Cryosphere Report, 2022, Growing Losses, Global Impacts. That report is a free download from ICCINet.org. I will put a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Julie, thank you for your work and for talking with us today.
All right. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'd like to talk about a couple of new science questions from the Julie Brigham Grett interview. Julie tells us only 3 million years ago there was no Greenland ice and no sea ice. Forest grew right up to the shores of the Arctic Ocean. How hot was it? Just 3 degrees C hotter than Earth was a few hundred years ago in pre-industrial times. The United Nations reports we are on course for 2.9 degrees C by the end of this century, unless we slash emissions drastically. It gets hotter after that. But many scientists think that is too optimistic. On our current emissions track, setting a new record again last year, Earth might reach 3 degrees of warming before 2100. Greenland will not suddenly emerge bare in the next 80 years. Experts think that process, unstoppable once it starts, would take a few centuries at least, because it's over a mile deep ice that has to melt away. But the Arctic sea ice could be gone now and then during this decade and possibly forever in following decades. That changes how much solar energy is reflected back into space. It creates hotter oceans, more heating, and changes in ocean currents and weather as far away as Tibet. How could it do that? The exact mechanisms connecting the Arctic sea ice and Tibet are still a field of developing science. It is a case of teleconnection. Analysis, satellite and ground-based, clearly shows a relationship between specific sea ice patterns in the Arctic and the weather in Tibet. Here is a good paper on what we know. Effects of Arctic sea ice in autumn on extreme cold events over the Tibetan Plateau in the following winter. Possible mechanisms. That is an open access article. It's free to you, and it's published October 2021. Find links in my show blog. We also learn from Julie that the Arctic is a living biosphere. She mentions the Arctic is full of living things, and this is partly new science. As Damian Carrington wrote in The Guardian, November 17th, the scientists collected surface meltwaters from 8 glaciers across Europe and North America and from 2 sites on the Greenland ice cap. They found tens of thousands of microbes in each milliliter of water. That's astounding. There's a lot of life going on up there, and we haven't really counted that in when we do our climate science. But here's the sort of new question that I think came up during this interview. Will a hotter Arctic Ocean capture less carbon and thus lead to more heating for all of us? Julie Brigham Grett uses the analogy of a warm champagne bottle or soda. It doesn't hold much bubbly when it's too hot. And that's carbon dioxide, that bubbly. Colder liquids hold more CO2. Surely that implies, even if the Arctic Ocean warms just a little, due to the vast area, that could mean many tons less carbon dioxide sucked into the sea compared to pre-industrial times. Every time a sink like the ocean can hold less, more of the greenhouse gas pollution from our tailpipes and smokestacks stays in the atmosphere, and that means more warming. Scientists have definitely shown the Arctic Ocean is getting more acidic, and that's in the Cryosphere 2022 report. But as far as we know, there has not yet been a study into the impact of polar ocean warming and carbon dioxide capture. It would be interesting to quantify this and then try some projections for low, medium, and high emission scenarios. I think we could be missing yet another factor that will heat the world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.